Hello, this is Beatrice Pavia with part one of the Pantograph of Friday, October 17th, 2025. We begin with page one, where the main story is headlined, Recycling Furniture for Families, Community Has Nonprofit Covered. Household helpers carry on after roof repairs, more are needed. This story is datelined Bloomington. Recycling Furniture for Families in downtown Bloomington invested about $170,000 to replace the roof of its 70-year-old warehouse and anticipates another $25,000 in capital projects over the next year. The nonprofit, which provides furniture and other necessities to eligible families living at or below the federal poverty line, was at risk of relocating from its Center Street location last year without a new roof. Frank Downs, executive director of Recycling Furniture for Families, said a roof replacement had been performed on the building about 13 years ago, but it was more of a layover of the existing roof. Because the roof was not sloped, it continued to collect water and contribute to significant leaks and water damage to the ceilings underneath it. As part of the most recent repairs, Downs said the original roof was torn off and all of the building's drainage had to be redone. Water damage within the facility was also fixed. We had the roof tapered now, so all the water runs to the back, so it's not sitting on the roof, Downs said. We've had some pretty decent-sized rains, and it worked great. Operations were only suspended for about a week and a half in June during the installation period. Outside of stormwater damage, Downs said one of the biggest problems was birds tearing up the roof. In response, the new roof features deterrent spinners to keep birds away. I think we'll be fine for the next 20 years, Downs said. Greg Meyer, who serves on Recycling Furniture for Families board, said he was grateful for the community support that kept the downtown warehouse as a viable resource for families in need. This is a very generous community once they know of a great need, and the roof at Recycling Furniture for Families is paramount, Meyer said, because you can't have a nonprofit if you don't have a place where it can be safe and dry. Although the roof is complete, Downs said other capital projects remain. The building requires about $7,000 in mortar work, and there are plans to replace the driveway on Center Street, he added. Over the last 20 years, Recycling Furniture for Families has served more than 500 families and given thousands of pieces of furniture on average per year. Last year, Downs had said that about 45% of clients were overcoming homelessness, 20% were living with a disability, and 17% were escaping abusive situations. To qualify for help, families must not have used the organization's services in the past and must meet certain financial guidelines. Except for large appliances, all items are donated to families and then delivered to their new homes free of charge. For information about donating to Recycling Furniture for Families, you can visit rf4f.org/donate. Monetary donations can also be mailed to the warehouse at 515 North Center Street in Bloomington. Volunteers will schedule pickups for anyone looking to donate their home furnishings. Donors can also drop off their goods on the east side of the building during normal operating hours, which are 9 to 5 Monday through Thursday and 9 to noon on Saturday. Our next front page story is about Congress, headlined Senate Dems Hold Out for ACA, Funding Bill Without Subsidies Fails Again. This is an Associated Press story, datelined Washington. Senate Democrats rejected for the 10th time Thursday a stopgap spending bill that would reopen the government, insisting they will not back away from demands that Congress take up health care benefits. The vote failed Thursday morning on a 51-45 vote, well short of the 60 needed to advance with the Senate's filibuster rules. The repetition of votes on the funding bill has become a daily drumbeat in Congress, underscoring how intractable the situation has become. It has been at times the only item on the agenda for the Senate floor while House Republicans left Washington altogether. The standoff has lasted more than 2 weeks, leaving hundreds of thousands of federal workers furloughed, even more without a guaranteed payday, and Congress essentially paralyzed. Every day that goes by, there are more and more Americans who are getting smaller and smaller paychecks, said Senate Majority Leader John Thune, Republican of South Dakota, adding that there have been thousands of flight delays across the country as well. While some bipartisan talks have been ongoing about potential compromises on health care, they have not produced any meaningful progress toward reopening the government. Thune also offered to hold a later vote on extending subsidies for health plans offered under Affordable Care Act marketplaces, but said he would not guarantee a result or an outcome. Democrats say they won't budge until they get a guarantee on extending the tax credits for the health plans. They warn that millions of Americans who buy their own health insurance, such as small business owners, farmers, and contractors, will see large increases when premium prices go out in the coming weeks. Looking ahead to a November 1st deadline in most states, they think voters will demand that Republicans enter into serious negotiations. The ACA crisis is looming over everyone's head, and yet Republicans seem ready to let people's premiums spike, said Senate Democratic Leader Chuck Schumer in a floor speech. Still, Thune also tried a different tack Thursday with a vote to proceed to appropriations bills, a move that could grease the Senate's gears into some action or just deepen the divide between the two parties. When they controlled Congress during the pandemic, Democrats boosted subsidies for Affordable Care Act health plans. It pushed enrollment under President Barack Obama's signature health care law to new levels and drove the rate of uninsured people to a historic low. Almost 24 million people get their health insurance from subsidized marketplaces, according to healthcare research nonprofit KFF. Democrats and some Republicans are worried that many of those people will forego insurance if the price rises dramatically. While the tax credits don't expire until next year, health insurers will soon send out notices of the price increases. In most states, they go out November 1. Senator Patty Murray, the top Democrat on the Senate Appropriations Committee, said she has heard from families who are absolutely panicking about their premiums that are doubling. They are small business owners who are having to think about abandoning the job they love to get employer-sponsored health care elsewhere or just foregoing coverage altogether, she added. Murray also said that if many people decide to leave their health plan, it could have an effect across medical insurance because the pool of people under health plans will shrink. That could result in higher prices across the board, she said. Some Republicans acknowledged that the expiration of the tax credits could be a problem and floated potential compromises to address it, but there is hardly a consensus among the GOP. House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican of Louisiana, this week called the COVID-era subsidies a boondoggle, adding that when you subsidize the health care system and you pay insurance companies more, the prices increase. President Donald Trump has said he would like to see a deal done for great health care, but has not meaningfully weighed into the debate. Thune insisted Democrats first vote to reopen the government before entering any negotiations on health care. If Congress were to engage in negotiations on significant changes to health care, it would likely take weeks, if not longer, to work out a compromise. Still, there was a growing sense on Capitol Hill that an end to the stasis is nowhere in sight. So many of you have asked all of us, how will it end? Said Johnson. We have no idea. And our final front page story is the Cutting Board column, this time headlined, Still Cooking History with Okra and Gumbo. There's a concept that's been coloring my view of culinary practices in America and really American life. It's not something like, what does it mean to be an American, or some unserious question on a civics blog. I mean, in the historical sense, how did we get here? Over the past five centuries or so, ever since European settlement and colonization really grasped first a foothold and then a stranglehold on these continents, how did life change for us humans, both in our relationship to one another and the world around us? From those first ships landing on the east coast of North and South America, there began a gradual and then a hurried, frenzied rush to replace what was indigenous to the Americas, the people, the culture, the food, with what was European and, unwittingly, what was African. You see, during those centuries of replacement and resettlement of people, culture, and provisions, there was a cross-pollination inside kitchens between cooking techniques and ingredients that saw European-style cuisine introduced to colonized flavors. Plentiful corn of the Americas was brought to Italy, where it would be used to make polenta. Potatoes arrived in France and were christened pommes de terre, apples of the earth. Pigs were introduced to the Americas by Spanish settlers, and they took over whole ecosystems. Rice, native to Africa, was turned into an entire agribusiness for the Carolinas, making them the rice capital of the world for centuries. So here's the logic. Several different cultures were forced together and squeezed through this tube called colonizing the New World, and we get a mashup of European, African, and indigenous cultures that becomes what we call American culture up and down the Atlantic portion of North and South America. None of this is to account for the contributions of Asiatic influences, by the way. That is another chapter. But Jack, I hear people scream through my computer screen, you're supposed to write about food. My friends, you cannot write about the history of gumbo without writing about the history of how it came to be. Gumbo is a mixture of African, French, and indigenous ingredients prepared in the style of Parisian chefs and French peasants. Perfected and passed it down by enslaved Africans to become one of the most iconic and quintessential dishes of the American South. So let us make some gumbo, and let us make some more. Like all stews, gumbo starts with the base and is layered from the start to the finish. I wanted to make a version entirely from products available at the downtown Bloomington Farmers Market. That meant I was not going to use shrimp because Illinois is a little far from a coast. Yes, Editor Kelsey, we have crayfish. No, I did not think to set out any traps. Yes, I will be doing this in the future. I was able to find most everything in the market, except a few things, most notably the smoked sausage. Smoked sausages like andouille are readily available in supermarkets, though. No, I cannot justify supermarket sausage and not supermarket shrimp. This is not lost on me. What I got from the farmer's market is here. 1 quart of okra, 3 sweet peppers, and a bunch of hot peppers from O'Rourke Family Gardens. Celery and garlic from the Table Farm and Workshop. 1 red onion from Middle Fork Farm. 1.5 pounds of chicken thighs from the Little Farm at Weldon Springs. And other ingredients, vegetable oil, about 1+ tablespoon. Smoked sausage, 2 links, 7 ounces. Flour from Janie's Mill, an Illinois product available at the Garlic Press in Normal. And rice for serving and garnishes. Step 1 was making a stock. After deboning the chicken thighs, I took the bones and trimmings from some of the vegetables and added it to a pot of cold water. I brought this to a boil, and then I covered it loosely and let it simmer. While this was happening, I prepped the rest of the chicken into bite-sized pieces and diced all my vegetables. Celery, onion, and sweet peppers went into one bowl, with hot peppers, minced garlic, and okra each having their own bowl. I cut the sausage into coins and added it to a pot over medium heat. This is the first layer of flavor. The fat in the sausage will render and start to brown the meat, leaching the spices and flavor into a fond. Once browned, I cut the heat and removed the sausage from the pan, leaving the fat and fond in the pan. Next up, brown the chicken. Same process, but you don't want to cook the chicken completely, just some good browning and fond. Cut the heat, remove the meat. And now for flavor level 2, the roux. Roux is a mixture of hot fat and flour that can range in color depending on how long you cook the flour. This gumbo calls for a dark roux that looks like peanut butter and chocolate. Add enough oil to the pan so that you have 2 tablespoons and turn the heat to medium-high. Then add an equal amount of flour and start stirring. Don't leave the roux. A dark roux like this needs to get cooked long enough so that it develops flavor and color, but not so long that it burns. It is a fine line, and that's why they say, if you've never burned a roux, you never made a roux. Once the roux is to your desired color, add the onion, celery, and sweet peppers. Reduce heat and stir. Keep stirring. This is layer 3. When the onions start to become translucent, add the garlic, layer 4. And once the garlic becomes fragrant, add the okra, level 5. Water from the other veg will have incorporated with the roux, making it a little soupy. The okra will thicken this as it cooks. Once the okra softened, I started adding the stock one ladle at a time, letting it incorporate fully before adding more. This is level 6. Continue until you have 2.5 quarts of stew. Add the meat back to the pot and allow to simmer. This is where you can taste for seasoning. I added a bunch of Cajun seasoning that I got from Alexander's Primetime Seasonings, available at the downtown Bloomington Farmers Market. I also added salt to taste and both white and black pepper, level 7. This was served with rice cooked in the same chicken stock and garnished with green onion. My brother and I sat down to eat them, and it was good, very good, in fact. The stew was thick, but not overly so. The vegetables were cooked well, the rice was tender and flavorful, and the spice level was correct. We did add hot sauce to taste because level 8. But something was missing, that brining flavor of the ocean. We put the leftovers in the fridge, and here's one of the many cool things about stew. It gets better the next day, and I'm nothing if not a madman. So I figured we would run it back using that gumbo rice and all as the body of another version, this time with sea bugs, 1.5 pounds of Argentinian shrimp purchased at Fresh Thyme Market in Bloomington. I went through the same process that day, only omitting more chicken, sausage, roux, vegetables, and then once I was to add the okra, I added the leftover gumbo and chicken stock to get my desired amount of stew. After adjusting the spices and adding a bit of salt, I added the peeled and deveined shrimp, lowered the heat to a scarce flame, and covered completely. After 5 minutes, I turned the heat off and let the residual heat gently cook the shrimp through. I served this with more green onions and topped with sriracha. Chris and I both agreed this was the one. I hope this one more accurately honors the crafters and stewards of gumbo. Using what I had at hand and finding that which I could, not wasting anything, treating each ingredient with respect for its contributions, and feeding my family. Stay curious, my friends, and don't be afraid to try something new or to admit when you need to adjust or, as we say in the world's finest Navy, correct your course. I'll see you on the next one. And if you are a farmer or a producer and would like to talk with me for this column, call me at 309-820-3275 or email daniel.alkire@lee.net, and be sure to check back next time to find out what we are chopping up on the cutting board. And we turn now to some local and state news. This one is titled, Body Cameras Ordered for ICE, Judge Startled by Use of Tear Gas on Protesters. This is an Associated Press story, datelined Chicago. Federal immigration officials in the Chicago area will be required to wear body cameras, a judge said Thursday, after seeing tear gas and other aggressive steps used by these officers against protesters. U.S. District Judge Sarah Ellis said she was a little startled after seeing TV images of clashes between agents and the public during President Donald Trump's administration's immigration crackdown. I live in Chicago, if folks haven't noticed, she said, and I'm not blind, right? Community efforts to oppose U.S. immigration and customs enforcement have ramped up in the nation's third largest city, where neighborhood groups have assembled to monitor ICE activity and film incidents involving agents. Separately, the Trump administration has tried to deploy National Guard troops, but the strategy was halted last week by a different judge. Ellis last week said agents in the area must wear badges, and she banned them from using certain riot control techniques against peaceful protesters and journalists. I'm getting images and seeing images on the news, in the paper, reading reports where I am having concerns about my order being followed, the judge said. And an attorney representing the government laid blame with one-sided and selectively edited media reports. And from the Names and Faces column, Fairbury Women's Club honors Citizen of the Year. The Fairbury Women's Club, part of the General Federation of Women's Clubs Illinois, named Kathy Cook as their 2025 Citizen of the Year. The club has honored outstanding volunteers since 1987. Cook was born in Fairbury and grew up in Sibley. She attended Western Illinois University, where she received a bachelor's degree in education, according to a news release. Cook started volunteering in high school by teaching Sunday school and started her teaching career in 1971. She taught first, third, and sixth grades throughout her career. She retired from teaching in 2004 after 33 years, the news release said. In 2006, her volunteering increased. She has worked 19 years to date at the Fairbury Community Food Pantry, which involves keeping inventory, organizing food drives, ordering food for distributions, and once a year town collection. The collection involved putting up flyers and organizing donations and volunteers. The food bank offers distributions once a month on Thursdays, as well as an evening distribution. Volunteers include church members and other volunteers from different organizations. Cook is also on the board of the Community Welfare Clearinghouse, which provides rental and utility assistance to residents, and has volunteered with the Bloodmobile for over a year, where she helps with registration, sends reminders through the mail, compiles blood drive information for newspaper articles, and submits them for publication. She is very active at church, where she assists with children's church by coming up with a craft or activity to go along with the minister's stories, and she works and organizes funeral dinners, including ordering food and gathering other church members to help. Once a week, she volunteers for a loom project that makes mats from plastic bags to give to people in need of a place to sleep. She helps out with the pancake and sausage breakfast and works the bake sale to benefit missions and other church projects. She is always happy to help family and friends if they need a ride to an appointment, and the group will host an open house in Cook's honor at 2 p.m. Sunday, October 26th at the United Methodist Church in Fairbury. All are welcome to join in celebrating Cook and her volunteer work. And here are some news briefs. The Family Community Resource Center invites the public to a free informational lunch for National Domestic Violence Awareness Month, featuring a discussion panel at the Bloomington Public Library at 205 East Olive Street. The center is partnering with Soroptimist International of Bloomington Normal and Mid-Central Community Action to host Having Conversations That Matter, a community discussion on domestic and intimate partner violence from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. on Wednesday, October 22nd. Our goal is to create a space where everyone feels welcome, whether you need support, want to help, or are just hoping to understand more, said Belinda Kennedy, CEO of the FCRC, in a press release. No one should have to face domestic violence alone. A discussion panel will feature speakers from the Center, the Soroptimus Club, MCCA, Brightpoint, Bloomington Police Department, the YWCA of McLean County, and Prairie State Legal Services. Staff from these organizations will also be on hand if those attending should seek private support. Lunch will be provided by Avantes. For more information and to register, contact Monique Tyus, the Program Support Specialist with FCRC, at 309-821-1616 or events@thefcrc.org. The event is free to attend, but registration is requested by Monday, October 20th. And Heartland Community College will host free workshops to help individuals complete the Free Application for Federal Student Aid, or FAFSA, for the 2026-27 school year. The workshops will be available at each regional Heartland location, which includes 5 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, October 28th, at Heartland's Pontiac campus at 211 East Madison Street, from 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday, October 30th, at Heartland's Lincoln campus at 2201 Woodlawn Road, and from 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday, November 6th, at Heartland's main campus, room 1112 at 1500 West Rab Road in Normal. Heartland financial aid professionals will guide students and families through the FAFSA process, answer questions, and provide personalized assistance with completing the form. The workshops are free, but pre-registration is required as seating is limited. Registration is available online at heartland.edu or by calling the financial aid office at Heartland. Those who plan to participate are asked to bring a driver's license or state ID, their 2024 federal income tax forms and W-2s, and amounts for untaxed income received in 2024. Attendees should also bring their parents' 2024 federal income tax forms and W-2s unless the prospective student was born before January 1, 2001, is married, is a supporting dependent, is a ward of the court, or an orphan, or served active duty in the U.S. military. And North 1750 East Road in Bloomington Township will be closed to through traffic starting Monday, October 20th. Traffic will be closed from Old Colonial Road to Harvest Hill Avenue for culvert replacement through October 24th. And the town of Normal will start vacuuming leaves on Monday, October 27th. This process could take multiple days and will not be done weekly, according to a statement from the town. And here is today's Flick Fact question. Streets traditionally have odd numbers on one side and evens on the other. Can you name the Twin City street that defies that and could be one of the only streets in America that has even numbers on both sides? And the answer is it's Division Street that divides Normal from Bloomington. And this has been Beatrice Pavia with part one of the Pantograph of Friday, October 17th, 2025. I look forward to reading part two with you next.